the fear that was so hard over there was the fear of the unknown. It's not that hard. This might sound stupid, but it's not that hard when things are happening, like, you're getting mortar, you're getting shot at. That's not the hard part for fear. The fear is not knowing what it is that's going on and seeing that something is about to happen, but you don't know what it is.
Welcome to There Is Hope. The advice or counsel given is provided for informational purposes only. Your host for There Is Hope, Richard Dover.
Welcome to There Is Hope Radio. Today I'm going to be interviewing Joshua Dover. Yes, has the same last name as mine because he is my son. And what we're going to be discussing is his experience of being a Marine and having the two tours of duty in Iraq. And the reason we're going to be doing this interview is to help individuals to understand what his story isn't like every Marine story, but what Marines have had to go through in a tour of duty in Iraq and just about being in the military. And also the reason we want to share this is because in different interviews with Joshua, we're going to be talking about his recovery and rehab from a motorcycle crash, and certainly his experience in the Marines has been of help to him. And Joshua, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yourself?
I'm doing well myself also. We should let people know that Joshua is in one state, I'm in another state, and he is recovering from a motorcycle accident, very severe crash. His voice, at times he may have to cough or hack or something or another because he is not always able to talk for a long period of time with his voice, but he wanted to do this interview. So as we do this interview, Joshua and I both, and again, we are father and son, and we have been on good terms, of bad terms, anything in between at times, but we are going to try to be as vulnerable as we possibly can because we think the more vulnerable we are, the more that's going to help those who are listening. There may be a subject that we start to cover, but either one of us may say, we're not going down that road, but we want to be as helpful as we can for the listening audience. So, Josh, are you ready to talk about the Marines?
Yes, I am.
Are you ready to talk about Iraq?
Yes.
So why don't we just start out to kind of give an idea to people, kind of just an introduction, when you went into the Marines and what your, is it called MOS, am I right?
Yeah, MOS, Military Occupational Specialty.
Okay, so talk about your MOS was and why you end up in Iraq. So why don't you just kind of give an intro on that at first?
Yeah, so I joined the Marine Corps in December of 2005, and obviously went to boot camp. I did go a little different than most in that I had a hernia prior to joining, and so the Marine Corps was a branch that allowed you to join even with a hernia, and they would do the operation on you to fix the hernia. So I ended up, because of going to boot camp during the holiday season, I ended up staying at boot camp for 7 months instead of the typical three because of the hernia operation. But I did my boot camp, did all my combat training and all that, and then I did schooling for the MOS is called 2171, electrical optical ordnance repairer, also known as a optics tech. So working on missile sighting system, thermal optics, night vision, that kind of stuff, all on the ground side of things. And so that was the job, so to speak, that I was trained to do. And it just so happened that when I left my school, training school, and got put in with my first unit, which was 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion out of Pendleton in California. They were all on vacation because they were a couple weeks out from deploying to Iraq. So when I got to my unit, the first thing I was told is, hey, in a couple weeks you're going to Iraq. And so that was kind of the start of my military career.
Okay. You go to Iraq and there was different titles for the war.
Yeah, there was different phases is what they called it. And so I can't remember the phase numbers that I was in, but if you see someone that was in the military that went to Iraq, you'll see like their medal that shows the Iraqi war that they were in, and then you'll see a star a Bronze Star for every extra time they were there. Typically, that would set deployments, but because phases are different than deployments, you can be like me, where I've only been to Iraq twice, but I have 3 medals for going to Iraq because I was in 3 different phases. And
okay.
So there was the initial phase, which is when the Marines, the Army, all that went in and fought directly against Saddam's army. And then after all that changed, it went to another phase, and then it continued through different phases. I was part of my second deployment, part of the phase where Iraq was kind of taking back its own country. And so we were supporting them in their goal to do Iraqi-held elections and stuff like that.
Okay. And then, so you went over there. You're not, so if I'm understanding it, you're not in direct combat, but were you part of the combat deployment, but you are the tech taking care of the equipment for combat? Is that a good way of describing it?
Yeah, so kind of both. I kind of held 2 roles. You always hear, you know, every Marine is an infantryman in the sense of you've been through your combat training and stuff like that, not as intense as say, infantry, but I kind of had 2 roles. One was I was the optics guy, so all of the vehicle sighting systems as well as the weapon systems for, you know, your night vision and your scopes that go on your rifle, stuff like that was the stuff I took care of. But I also did foot patrols and, you know, did the whole going into the huts and clearing huts and you know, cordoning villages and looking for what they call high-value targets and stuff like that. So I was kind of playing a dual role with that.
But I wanted to get into the parts that I know because of knowing, as you'd share at times, is you're going out in the, what I understand, in an armored vehicle in the middle of nowhere to meet up with I assume infantry is the name. I don't know what the name is. Your job was to make sure the equipment is working. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so when with the first light armored recon, they have these vehicles called light armored vehicles, and they're fast attack vehicles with a 25-millimeter gun on them. And those, our whole purpose, our unit, is we're called tip of the spear because we go into enemy territory and we, you know, kind of break things up. And there's always LEV-25s that are out there needing their sights and everything checked on and fixed and all that. And so what would happen is, and this was more in the second deployment for me, I was attached to the maintenance vehicle. So our vehicle was a little bit different, equipped to be able to do the optics, but also do, we had mechanics and stuff like that that would go with them. And then we were always attached to a platoon of these guys that would go out with these vehicles that had ground troops. They're like infantry that are inside the 25, the LEV-25. And so I would go in the same places that they would go. It's just I was there just in case something happened. You know, vehicle breaks down, then we had a mechanic on the vehicle. If the optic system goes down, there's me on the vehicle, and we're there instantly to be able to fix things. And so we basically, like I was saying before, kind of did double duty where we were a maintenance crew, but we were also part of the attack team, if that makes sense. And
okay.
So it was like kind of being doing the job that the others were doing, but then also having my main job as well.
You know, and you and you would talk to just a few times we could talk when you were over in Iraq. I would listen to you and the things that you talk about, and I would think, well, he's got a safe job. He's safe. And what I'm hearing is probably for the first time, actually is the first time, it kind of bothers me because I find out you weren't so safe.
I can kind of give you one time that you might remember. I was talking to you. I was on base at the time, and I was talking to you through a satellite phone, and I told you that I kind of abruptly ended the conversation, said I had to go. I gave you some kind of excuse and then got off the phone. And never told you this till now, but that was because we were being attacked by mortar fire. And so because of that, I kind of had to stop the conversation and get geared up and everything else. So there was definitely stuff going on, but obviously as a individual over there, you don't want to worry your family or anything, so you're not going to, you know, say, hey, I got to go, we're getting shot at.
Right.
But
right.
So that was one of the conversations I remember specifically talking with you on the phone, and I had to abruptly kind of end the conversation, and I don't remember what the excuse I used, but I kind of lied to you to make sure, you know, you're not sitting there going, well, shoot, he just got shot at.
Whatever you told me, I actually knew something wasn't right, and you were lying to me about something. I didn't know what, I didn't know what it was, but I knew something wasn't right. So then what I wanted to get into is somebody hears that and says, well, yeah, okay, so yeah, there's some mortars and stuff, and but he's not the actual guy that's really going into it. But in the midst of it, you are literally gone at times in the middle of nowhere. And what I want to talk a little bit about, because people think, well, yeah, he is not the same as the other guys. But you shared a story with me, a couple of different stories with me, and I want our listeners to get an idea that if you're in a war, you're in battle, it doesn't matter what your MOS is. If you're being out in Iraq or Afghanistan or someplace like that, it's probably, no matter where you're at, not the safest thing by just wearing a uniform. But I remember you talking about the fear, the ongoing fear that you would have, and I think, can you admit that as Marines you guys have fear?
Oh, heck yeah! There's not a person on the planet that doesn't have fear, and it's just a matter of what you do with it, you know. And if you've seen stuff like Private Ryan and stuff like that, it's a pretty good depiction. There's different ways that people deal with it, and some people freeze up, and some people continue on with the mission. And I mean, it's something that you don't really know how you'll react until that moment comes.
Do you react? Can the same person react differently at different times?
You know, I'm sure that it probably can. On my own experience, every time something came down, I mean, I had a rocket fired at me. And thankfully they missed and stuff like that. And every time I had stuff that was near death, I was always kind of like, I pushed it out of my head and just continued on. And it wasn't until years later that it came back to kind of so-called haunt me, because I didn't deal with it at the time. I just said, hey, I got a mission to do. I got things I got to do. And I just kind of pushed it away.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that, and we'll get to that on the second interview, because that's where the PTSD comes in. And when I found out that you really had a big issue with PTSD, it was a shocker to me, because my son Josh can handle anything. And I really questioned, and I can't really be about Josh, but the very thing you said is why many, and it's not just military, it can be all kinds of different events. I mean, whether it's a police officer, military, it could be an ambulance, it could be anybody. Through a divorce, it could be. But PTSD is real. I don't think it's real for everybody. I think some people are fake, okay? I'll just be honest. But it can be real, and that you just gave an example of what can happen. The way you learn how to cope with things is to ignore it, but sooner or later it does come back.
It absolutely does, and it kind of creeps up on you. And I honestly didn't know that I had PTSD. All I knew is I had problems, and I had, you know, thoughts and everything else that was just haunting me. And finally, I reached out and asked for some help, and through some counseling, found out that some of these problems that I was dealing with was due to having PTSD.
So now I wanted to cover, because you said that the way you dealt with a lot of things was you just did what you had to do at the time and buried it, and it gave you the ability to, you know, to cope and deal with it. And and that's going to fit in when we talk about your recovery from recovering, because you haven't recovered from your motorcycle accident.
Yeah, still in the middle of it.
But you're in the middle. You're in the middle of it. You're nowhere close. Maybe by the time people hear this interview, you'll be over it. I don't know. you would hope so, but
absolutely.
in the midst of it, you told me at times, and I want us to cover how, again, some guys how they dealt with stuff. But you told me you could be out in the middle of nowhere, totally exposed, and then you got to go to the bathroom. And the fear of that. can you talk about what was that fear like? I mean,
just to give you ideas. So with First Light Armored Recon, my second deployment, we were actually pulled off our task and sent up into northern Iraq on the Syrian border because the Army was actually getting some pretty big casualties because of having a lot of Al-Qaeda issues going on up north. And so we were sent there to kind of so-called spearhead it and disrupt the enemy movement and flow and everything. And a lot of where we were at, we lived off the vehicles. We had a home base, and then we lived 1 month straight out in the desert. And we would be resupplied once a week by either a helicopter or convoys would come out and resupply us with fuel and food and everything. But we lived literally in the middle of the desert. Every single day, we would move to a different location. We would go cordon off cities, do a lot of stuff to stop the enemy from taking control of the area, so to speak. And we would be, a lot of times, three vehicles at a time in a group. And, the whole unit's got about 20 for the unit that it was with. We had about 20 vehicles, but we were usually attached with two other vehicles. And we would sleep literally on the ground with our heads up against our wheels of our vehicles while two Marines had to stay awake and make sure that nobody was sneaking up on us. And so there's, the knowledge
how,
is
how well did you
laying
sleep?
There. It's funny, people ask that all the time, and you would think it'd be hard because you're constantly afraid, but you're also constantly worn out. And so
yeah, you were working,
sleep
what,
comes
hours
instantly.
A day at
oh,
night?
Yeah, you get up. When we were in the middle of the desert, you get up before dark, and we would start our vehicles together at the same time so that the enemy couldn't tell how many there was of us. And then we'd go around, do our patrols and everything. We'd go in and into villages and meet with the sheikhs that are, the people in charge. We'd gather intel, that kind of stuff. We would go through door-to-door, stuff like that, and then we would do all this until nightfall, and then we would go to sleep after it gets dark. And so it's a long day, and so the instant your head hits that tire, you're out like a light. And the only thing going to wake you up is if you hear a certain sound or a Marine's voice or something like that, you wake up ready to do, your weapon is literally laying on you. You're ready to go at any moment's notice, but you fall asleep so easy it's not even funny. You're just so exhausted.
But what about when you the threat of the enemy at any time, and at night you talked about when you would be on whatever you call it.
Yeah, when you're on guard is what you're thinking of.
Yeah. So when you were on guard, you had told me that you were on guard and you have no idea there was two of you, correct?
Yeah, so it was. It depends on what time we're talking about, but there was a time in my first deployment when I was on a base. It was an outpost, basically, out in the middle of kind of nowhere, where two giant highways kind of converge, and there was two of us during the day on a post, and at night there was only one of us on a post. And so you would be by yourself, and where we were at, the city lights were so bright off in the distance, probably 20, 25, 30 miles away, that it would blind out your night vision goggles, and so you couldn't use them, because when you look out, all it does is blur the image in your eyes, and so you would have to use your eyes to look in the dark. And anybody that's gone outside in a place that doesn't have lighting, street lights and all that kind of stuff, and you try to see with just your eyes, you see what, 20 feet in front of you before you can't see much of anything. And that's kind of how those posts were. And so we'd get called up on the radio and found out that a post that was only a couple kilometers away had just got shot up. You know, people drove by and started shooting at the post. And so, you know, be prepared. And so you're sitting there intently staring in the darkness, unable to see anything because it's dark. And all of a sudden you'd see movement and you're not allowed to just fire at movement. And so you're not sure if that's an enemy getting ready to fire on you. You're not sure if that's a wild dog, none of that. And so it's the fear that was so hard over there was the fear of the unknown. It's not that hard, this might sound stupid, but it's not that hard when things are happening like, you know, you're getting mortared, you're getting shot at. That's not the hard part for fear. The fear is not knowing what it is that's going on and seeing that something is about to happen, but you don't know what it is.
Okay, this
kind of the unknown.
This focus on that, because that is the reality for every human being.
Yep.
All of us have the fear of the unknown, the fear of maybe you know just enough to not know, right? You know, there's potential danger. It's not an irrational fear. There's potential danger, potential death. There's obligation that you have because you're responsible at that moment for the lives of others. And dealing with all that, this ties us into your right now, what you're dealing with your rehabilitation, with your surgery. And this explains a lot to me. I talk to you, and at times you're very depressed and you're just discouraged. And most of the time, it's what you have said is when you don't know if you're going to have another surgery or not. You don't know with right now the danger is going on with your hip. You don't know if something's been damaged or not. Man, that could just bring on all kinds of memories of the fact of, again, just the unknown and the fear of what could happen. It kind of explains how you kind of going through the struggle, doesn't it, with what you're going through?
Definitely. I think that the key here is a lot of times when you have the unknown, your mind begins to try to fill in the unknown with what it thinks could happen. And when you do that, when you allow your mind to do that, you come up with some of the worst scenarios there is. And so just to give you an example, I just got back from x-rays today for problems I'm having with my hip, which has got more hardware in it than some automobiles, you know.
But it's expensive hardware.
It is. It's very. But because of the fact that even the doctors are unsure and they're requesting x-rays because they're unsure of what's going on and there's uncertainty in them, that brings on a lot of anxiety for me. And then I start playing off in my brain, well, it could be this, it could be that. You never go to the simple things. Your brain always wants to go to the worst thing possible. And so that's the problem with the unknown is a lot of times you come up with these things that could potentially be going on or, you know, are about to happen that are 10,000 times worse than what actually really ends up happening.
It's very rare that you
come out with the what you think is going to happen and that actually is what happens.
So just stop there for a second. So let's go back. You had to deal with that multitudes of times when you're in Iraq, just as you described being on guard duty. How did you not go crazy in the midst of those times when you don't know that? I mean, one, you're hoping, you're praying for daylight. I can't wait for daylight.
There is nothing better than daylight when you can see things.
So how did you cope were there times that you were just absolutely overcome with fear that at any moment somebody's going, and you told me one of the dangers that the idea is that they're not just going to shoot and kill you. They're going to sneak up behind you because if they shoot and kill you, then people hear the gunfire so that they could sneak up on you and strangle you or whatever, or all that kind of stuff. So how did you learn to deal with that?
Well, I guess you just, it depends, I guess. There's a lot of different ways, you know, people deal with things. But for me, I dealt with the heart racing, the perspiration, the anxiety, your breath being kind of almost hyperventilating kind of thing. But, I mean, to give you an example, I had one time I heard a sound behind my post that sounded like somebody stepping on a water bottle, and I couldn't figure out how somebody had somehow snuck up on me, and I thought they must be right behind me getting ready to shoot me, and I pulled the knife out of my sheath that was on my chest because I didn't think I had enough time to grab my weapon, and I spun around and slashed the air thinking I was going to slash an enemy that was about to kill me, and there was nothing there.
Not another comrade.
Yeah, and good thing. And that is why we have certain protocols. You know, you don't just sneak up on a post.
Right.
You got to yell your intentions and all that. But, you know, stuff like that where I could have just been frozen. I mean, there's many reactions. You know, they used to say that there's the fight or flight, and there's fight, flight, and then there's a third one. I wish I could remember right now. My brain's kind of not totally here because of the accident, but there's actually three things now. There's another one.
Yeah,
that there
I've
is.
Heard the other one, and I can't remember. They talk about it when it comes to school shootings and shootings
yep.
in malls. But you were also trained, so I want us to cover that. You're trained in the military. I mean, you're given all this training to deal with all these different things on that, but you're still a human being. But as you're talking, is in the midst of it, is you didn't freeze up, you dealt with it. And I want to tie this in to, again, some of your motorcycle crash and rehabilitation stuff, is that one of the things that I think that it has helped you in being the Marine, and that's a whole, again, another discussion, but since we kind of covered this, is that there are things for coping skills and tools and things you learned in the military, that you learned in the Marines, that deal with stuff that you can draw upon as you're going through your rehabilitation.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
You're not frozen in bed. I don't know, maybe for 2 days you were frozen in bed. I don't know. But you're not frozen in bed. You're doing some things. There is the fear. But, you know, some people here, so this be real, some people wouldn't get the x-rays that you got because they're afraid of what the x-rays may show.
No, I get that.
They get worse and worse and worse. And how many
yep.
people that are listening to us, they have gone into the frozen mode. So there's people listening to us that they're coping with life by, and when they have fear and everything, they just freeze and they don't do anything. So they don't deal with the issues. They don't handle them. They're just at a place that they become just immobilized. And the issue is whatever your fear. So if you would have become immobilized, guess what? It was a bad guy. You'd be dead.
Yeah. And that's the reality of it.
And how many people are dying, not literally, but dying inside because they've become immobilized to not be able to find a way to deal with whatever they're going through. And again, that
yep.
could be that they're going through a divorce. It could be that have had an accident, going to rehabilitation like you, that maybe they've lost their job and they've just become immobilized. They're fearful to ever get a job again because, you know, this was the best job they ever had and they'll never get a better job and da-da-da-da-da. You know, it goes on and on and on and on. And there has to become a place where you cope with life. And like you've said, there's things that you didn't freeze, but there's also things you didn't deal with maybe in the best way. And so then things haunt you years later. And so it's a process of learning how to cope with life better. And so, Joshua, you have no excuse for not doing it all right now. So when you're going through your rehabilitation, you're supposed to – you've gone through all the training. You have all the skills. You've got all the experience to be able to do it right. But probably sometimes you still don't do it right.
Oh, I have failed quite a bit in my recovery, but as long as the progress is kind of an upward trend, and you may take a couple steps back, but as long as you're kind of moving forward and somebody looking at you sees the forward momentum, even if there's a little back every now and again, that's the key. Nobody's expecting you to stay forward the whole way.
And I was saying that is why you're alive today, and there's even stories behind all that, is because there's the pressing forward. I have a saying, and is that it's okay if we fall one step backwards as long as we fall two steps forward because we're still ahead. And the problem is that some people, when they fall backwards, they then look backwards. And when they
yep.
look backwards, when they're falling, they not only fall, they're down on the ground.
Yeah, you go where you look.
Back up.
It's like
and
a motorcycle.
So,
you go where you look.
yeah, you go where you look, exactly. Well, we've run out of time, And obviously, we can't just stop the interview with Josh about his experience in Iraq now, because we're going to leave you hanging now on a lot of different things. So, Josh, what we're going to do is we're going to end this interview, and then I'm sure you're more than willing to do another interview with me on this topic, right?
Yeah, as long as you guys can bear with my voice, we're good to go.
Okay, and it may take two or three to get through this journey. I just want to remind individuals, you're listening to There Is Hope Radio, because we think there is hope, that there is hope for anybody and everybody, know what they've gone through. I can tell you, I'm a person, if I shared my personal story, I've been a person that has been totally hopeless, been suicidal, had the gun to my head and all those kind of things. I'm alive today. I know there's hope. Josh has gone through his own things many times, I'm sure, and yet he's still alive today. And for you that is listening right now, there is hope. And maybe you're even a Marine that has PTSD, that's going through a lot of different things, and you don't even want to be alive. I want you to know there's hope. And hopefully, through what Joshua shares of his own story, it will give you some hope. What I wanted to end with is to let you know that for me personally, I'm one who believes the hope is through Jesus Christ. Our show is called There's Hope, that through Jesus Christ we can have hope, that he will give us the strength when we have no strength. God is on our side, that he's for you. He's not against you, no matter what you've done, no matter where you've been, no matter whatever dot life you've had, no matter what actions you've ever taken in life, that there's a God that loves you, that cares for you. I believe that's part of Joshua's story also through this whole motorcycle crash. I want us to end the show to let you know there is hope. If you need someone to talk to, I want you to know that we're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call a phone number. It's a toll-free number. It's 1-866-WANT-GOD. Real easy to remember. 1-866-WANTGOD. 1-866-WANT-GOD. You can call 24 hours a day. At any point in time, we'll pray with you. We'll talk with you. We'll do anything that we can to be of help to you, to help you to be able to make it through whatever you're going through. Joshua, thank you for sharing your story. And we're going to go right back into another interview with you.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.